All of you who were here last week and the week before, don't get scared by this question. But how many of you, this is your first time? Okay, starting in the beginning. Some questions may come up, and I'll do a couple of things very, very fast. And one way is to segue some criticism that's come into the JCC about this series, because it's called the Sword of Allah. Well, okay, it's the sword of Adonai. It's the sword of Elohim. It's the same God doing business in the same location for 5,000 plus years. And the sword is part of the logo of Islam because they recognize that they spread by the sword. It was an aggressive religion. It was what's called technically, I used a couple of technical words last time, which is it's a syncretic religion, meaning to synchronize. The Christic in there is not Christian. It means it's trying to synchronize Judaism, Christianity, and itself into a third and complete religion in much the same way that Baha'i is a syncretic religion. Scientology, not so much. Most religions are created from previously existing materials, and Islam is no exception. At the end of last week's lecture, I was talking about what marks an aggressive triumphalist religion, and one of the great questions that came up from right back there on the aisle was the business about how the religion is disseminated, and that Islam was an aggressive religion, and you can tell that because the religion passes through the father. Judaism was not after, in modern times, an aggressive religion, and religion passed through the mother for obvious military and biological reasons, and that Christianity started out as a subversive religion that spread quietly, surreptitiously, beneath the radar of the Greeks and the Romans. And there was a considerable ethnic controversy in the spread of early Christianity. And it did not become a triumphalist religion until it was picked up by the sword of Constantine. So religions go through various phases. Judaism, of course, you all know, originally was patrilineal. When you read the Hebrew scriptures, it's clearly patrilineal. It doesn't become matrilineal until close to the year 1000 in the Common Era. So that's some of where we ended up last week. Talked about how rapidly, amazingly rapidly, Islam spread, unlike Christianity, that took 324 years in order to be picked up by a major figure and become a large and successful religion. Its spread was truly remarkable. Again, let me give you the dates of Muhammad's birth. 570, his death about 640, 642. But by 640, it had spread all the way to the middle of North Africa and up almost to Turkey. By 750, it is up to the Pyrenees and across the Pyrenees and going towards the heart of France. And it's up into Turkey, and it's struggling against Byzantium. Part of the reason for that was how simple the message was. It gave you one God. It tried to give people everything that their native religions gave them, so that if you were a Jew, you didn't have to give up the story of Adam. You didn't have to give up Moses. You didn't have to give up the Exodus. Now, for those of you who have been in Egypt, you understand that Egyptian Islam has a more ambivalent relationship with the Exodus than the rest of Islam does, because they're trying to kind of give, you know, credit to their pharaohs. But the Exodus story is in the Quran in various locations. So Jews are given everything. Muhammad thinks that Jews are given everything that they need to have in order to convert. And he believes that followers of Jesus are given everything they need in order to convert. Jesus is born of a virgin. Miriam, same name again. And the angel Gabriel goes to Miriam and says, "You're going to have a baby." And she says, "How can this be when no man has touched me, nor have I been unchaste?" And Gabriel says, "God says be, and the thing is." So it's very much like Genesis 2. It's conception by the word. What Muhammad doesn't do, and this is really important, so for the people that have heard this before, it's very important. What Muhammad doesn't do is a Christology involving the death of Jesus. Jesus is a prophet. His name is Isa, or Isa. And he lives and he dies. And that's it. There's no transforming experience theologically or historically with his death. Nor does the Quran deny anything about his death. It doesn't talk about it except for the very brief passage that says the Jews didn't kill the Messiah, which is 2,000 years before the Roman Catholic Church kind of said it, and Williamson never said it. But I have a responsible opposing point of view here.
The Quran actually says he was not crucified.
I'll go on with that. The Quran says the Jews didn't kill the Messiah. There are three understandings of that passage. One is that, of course not, nothing happens that God doesn't ordain. The second is, of course not, the Romans did. And the third is Simon the Cyrene took his place, or Judas recanted and took his place. But you're absolutely correct. In the Quran, there is no cross. There's no meaning to the death of Jesus. Now, this is puzzling to many scholars, because this is, as Sherlock Holmes in the story of the Silver Blaze said, did you notice the remarkable thing about the dogs barking? I didn't hear the dogs barking. That's the remarkable thing. The dog that doesn't bark in the Quran is the crucifixion. And that leads me to believe, and the reason that I have gone on and on for now three sessions talking about Jews that Muhammad met and followers of Jesus, I have not been calling them Christian, because I believe, and some other scholars believe, there's no unanimity on it, so I'm not giving you this as settled scholarship, but many scholars believe that there's no refutation of the death of Jesus and its significance, because Muhammad didn't meet post-Nicene Christians. Even though he was living from 570 to 640-642, and Nicaea took place in 324-325, the theory is that when you got into the middle of the Arabian Peninsula, that he was meeting people from the primitive church, people who were pushed out of Jerusalem and pushed out of that part of the Levantine before Nicaea. And so these were primitive followers of Jesus who were called followers of the light. I was involved in a thing with my newspaper today. We were not surprisingly discussing a theological issue, and it came up about whether Nero threw Christians to the lions. And the answer is, it depends on what you mean by Christians. It doesn't depend what you mean by lions. This one we're pretty safe on. Because by the year 68, Christianity has not yet been born. Christianity is not born on the year zero. Of course, neither was Jesus. He was probably born in the year 6-7 before himself. And he was almost certainly born in the spring, because part of the... in the Gospels, what you can really kind of take to the bank is the eternal truth. As the word went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed, this we believe. And that almost always happened in the springtime. You wouldn't do it in the fall when you're harvesting. You do it in the spring after the lambing and so forth. So the feeling is that Muhammad did not know about Christians in our sense of the word, that Christians were born before he was, but not in his part of the Arabian Peninsula. So he doesn't encounter Christianity as we understand it. He doesn't. His followers encounter it when they sweep out of the Arabian Peninsula and get up to Jerusalem and Damascus and Baghdad and Cairo and Kairouan. And there are these terrible fights. And these terrible fights take place, and these Muslims win. They win from the sword. They win because of their passion. They win because of the simplicity of their message. And they win because of the disarray that Christendom is in, because they are unsurprisingly fighting amongst themselves. And there is not one simple holy Roman church. In my next paragraph, I'm going to talk about the illusions of denominations and organizations that we have, that we think that Christianity is split into the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestant Church. Well, it's just not true. There are a dozen religions that call themselves Catholic, and there are thousands of religions that call themselves Protestant, and there are a bunch of harbor religions in between that you can't really tell what they are when you're a high Episcopalian or something that Garrison Keillor makes up. They're just all kinds of other religious groups. I talked last week, and this is at the heart of what's important tonight when we're talking about Islam's encounter with the West, and that is talked about the big fights that went on in Islam. And Islam is divided generally. Let me give you a more relevant picture. We all know generally into the Sunni and the Shiite. But even though I'm going to explain this in painful detail, that's like understanding Christianity is divided into Catholic and Protestant. There are dozens of different groups of Shia and dozens of different groups of Sunni. And so it's never as easy as it may seem. It's like trying to get two Hasidic courts to agree on whether that wine is kosher enough. In principle, the Shiites descend themselves from the Prophet Muhammad, his daughter Fatma, and his nephew, son-in-law Ali. When you see names in Muslim history that have the words Ali or Fatma or Fatimid in them, it tells you that they consider themselves to be part of the Shia movement, that they consider that the legacy of the Prophet should be handed down through his bloodline. So you get the Ishmaelites, you get the Alawites, and of course you get the Fatimid Caliphate. The Sunni believe in a kind of divinely inspired democracy, the way that God uses God's divine hand in order to select a pope, present pope accepted, basically, you all know the story that when Alexander the Great was dying, his generals gathered around him and they said, "Alex, Zuckmerapis, to whom do you leave the empire?" And he said, "To the strongest." And that's pretty much the way it works in the Sunni world. You're supposed to be in the Quraysh tribe and the tribe of the prophet, but pretty much it's a war. And it's a war that goes on, and I would love to tell you that it's really simple and you could put all of the Sunni in one area of the world and all of the Shiite in another area of the world and they stayed that way, but it doesn't work like that. That there have been tribes that changed back and forth from Sunni to Shia, and you might ask yourselves, well, how is it that people can change whether they're in the bloodline of the prophet or they're not in the bloodline of the prophet? I have a very easy demonstration of how easy that is. How many of you are Sephardim? Okay. Now let's try this one. How many of you are Ashkenazi? How many now? Okay. Now how many Ashkenazi here came from Poland? I have a word for you. So much of this is folklore. If you look up the, for example, the most famous, controversial Sephard in English history was Benjamin Disraeli, who was an Anglican, but don't let that stop you. Of his four grandparents, two of them were Ashkenazi and two of them were Sephardic. And not on either side. The Ashkenazi was married to the Sephard and the Sephard was married to the Ashkenazi. So what is he? When Poland, Ashkafardic. This is what my wife and I were called up to do an aliyah for the bat mitzvah of a girl. It happened to be, I'm sorry for the digression, but you made me. It happened to be on the anniversary of my bar mitzvah in exactly the same synagogue, although they redecorated the sanctuary and almost come to blows over what color to make the carpet. And I get up there and we're doing it and we were just in classic Ashkafardic because both of us learned at exactly the moment when the Ashkenazi was being changed for the Sephardic. And you can kind of date the generations when they make Aliyah and you find out whether they're Adonaiing you or Adonaiing you. Anyway, all of which is to say that after the diaspora out of Spain, a lot of Jews went to Turkey, some to North Africa, some to Italy, and then the Poles said, you know, we have an aristocracy, but we don't have anybody that knows how to do anything, so they imported the Jews who had come from Spain through Italy. So it's kind of, this is the other question that I love to ask people. How many of you are Levites or Levites? Okay, so how do we know? Yeah, because your father told you. Right. So when you go through there are two things that you find out when you travel through the Arab world. One of them is that every country says that their accent and their language is closer to the language of the prophet and of the Quran than any other. So you meet Algerians who say this with a straight face. You meet Syrians who say... We believe what we want to believe. So there are people that have been Shiite, they've been Sephardic. There's a very small group called Kharijite, which just means, Kharijite is Arabic. I'm not making this up. For enjoy yourselves, I'm going away. I just as soon missed this conversation. When the Sunni and the Shia were fighting, the Kharijite said, Zygazint, we'll talk to you later. And it may not surprise you. Did any of you take Ken Blatty's course here? Did he talk about the Jews on Jerba? Okay. The Jews on Jerba are Kharijites. Well, I'm sorry. The Muslims on Jerba are Kharijites, and the Jews are indistinguishable from them, which means we think that they've all been swimming in the same gene pool. And the Kharijites had the wisdom to just say, you know, this isn't important stuff. This should be about ethics, not about bloodlines. So they're still fighting about this. And about 82% of the world of Islam is Muslim, and is Sunni, and about 13% is Shiite. The religious differences are not huge. They're actually not really fighting each other over whether to pray with their hands like this or whether to pray with their hands like this. Very few Ashkenazic parents don't want their children to date Sephardic kids because they eat rice at Pesach. These are, I'm sorry if anybody's really into the rice thing, I don't mean to offend you, but these are not the killer issues. They're the identifying issues that we rationalize our differences around. What this is about in the modern world is ethnicity, with the largest Shia nation being Iran and being ethnically Persian, and most of the Arab world, not all of the Arab world, but most of the Arab world being Sunni. And so you have ethnic conflicts. And the great quote that I quoted, which is not my own, last week, is the old African saying, when elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. And Israel is the grass in this much larger struggle between the Sunni and the Shia, and between the Persians and the Arabs, which is why the Israelis have played a very interesting and cunning game with relationships with both sides, both above, both visible and invisible, meeting with Arabs, negotiating with Arabs, being in co-development deals with Arabs, and the same thing with Iranians. So there's a lot of good stuff that goes on below the surface, and a lot of terrible stuff that goes on above the surface. But the thing to know is that there are relationships. Will they be fruitful? Does it mean peace in our time? That's not the way to bet in terms of on our time. But it's important to understand that it's not as bad as it looks from some viewpoints. It certainly is as bad as it looks when you have stuff being reined in on your head, and they are Katyushas and now even longer range and better guided missiles. So why the animus? Why all the anger? Why is Israel such an insult to the entire Arab world? Why, with all of this territory, from even forgetting the New World and forgetting all of the Muslim influence today in, yes, Argentina, and all of the Muslim missionary work that's going on in Chiapas, and all of the Muslim community and its power in Orange County or in the Detroit area, forget the New World. Why would, because in our country, most other countries, we are not religiously identified. But going all the way from Mauritania across North Africa and all the way down into Black Africa and the Arabian Peninsula and up through Turkey and across to Afghanistan and Pakistan and India, which is the second largest Muslim country in the world, and Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world. Why, with all of this territory, is this tiny little thing of Israel the most impossible cancer in the belly of the Arab Muslim world that they cannot live with? It is such an insult that they cannot, it's just not tolerable. They can't even call it Israel. It's the Zionist entity. It is something that is beyond rational calculation. In terms of when you go, why? Well, Zionism is a racism. Every Arab country has Islam, every, no exceptions, every Arab country has Islam as their national religion. I can't think of an Arab country, I'm being very technical here because I'm not talking about Iran or Turkey, and I'm not talking about Pakistan, but every Arab country, I can't think of any that have religious freedom, that would offer religious freedom to Christians or offer religious freedom to, God forbid, Jews. But with Israel, which is the only country in the Middle East that is a democracy, and if I sound like a Zionist, it's because I am. It's the only country in the Middle East that's a democracy. It's the only country in the Middle East where minority religions have any freedom of religion. What's this about? Well, one of the things that I left out, I think I left out of my biography, is that I studied psychotherapy in Vienna. And the answer to the question really is a lot of ways a psychological issue. We don't have a war on terrorism. We don't have a war on terror. We have a war on terrorism. If we had a war on terror, we should bomb them with Xanax and give them really good therapy. The issues around the Arab identity are really complicated. And one of the problems is that we tell history differently. And all of us do. I mean, when Jewish people tell the story of the expulsion from Spain in 1492, we don't ever talk about the expulsion of the Muslims from Spain in 1492. Strangely enough, when the Muslims talk about their expulsion in 1492, we missed that boat. We're not part of their story. There's kind of an equal historical amnesia in terms of the good times and in terms of the suffering. Islam, when they talk, in the Arab world, when they talk about their encounters with the West, they talk about the Crusades. They talk about those really mean, nasty Crusaders in the year 1076, approximately, who got it in their heads to take back the Holy Land. Now, I have to tell you, this is an absolutely true story as I was researching for this lecture. And I know it looks like I do no prep at all, but the truth is I do an extraordinary amount of prep and I have eyes in the back of my head. As I was doing the research for this lecture and boning up on some of it today, I ran across a Catholic site that tried to apologize for the Crusades. And the language that they used was exactly the language of Al-Qaeda. Exactly the language of Al-Qaeda. It was, they have our holy shrines. Those non-believers are desecrating our holy shrines. What belongs to Christendom once belongs to Christendom eternally. And we have to purify those shrines and regain our honor. And I'm looking at this. And I'm going, I'm looking for Osama bin Laden's name on the bottom of this. And this was from a legitimate Catholic historical society. This should do two things for you. It should appall you that any modern thinking person can be using this language within a Christian context. And it should give you hope that it's such a marginal opinion, and it was a mainstream opinion, and it is, with certain exceptions like Bishop Williamson, it has pretty much been purged from legitimate Catholicism. This has got to give you the hope that someday it can be purged from Islam too, that these issues can be remediated, that as bad as things are today, they don't have to be bad forever. When the Muslims tell the story of their encounters with the West, they talk about losing Spain. They never talk about capturing Spain. Interesting, huh? They talk about the glory of Granada. They talk and Osama bin Laden started all of his stuff by declaring that Al-Andalus was now and forever Muslim territory. And last week I talked about how the rules are different in theory in the Quran between, well, you've got your house, it's a nice house, I'd really like it, but I'm not allowed to murder you to take your house. You know, a Muslim lived in that house before you did. Now I can murder you to take the house back because a Muslim lived there before. There are different rules in theory, not so much in practice, but in theory, about what you are allowed to do to regain your property. And last week I mentioned, and this bears repeating, that historical memory, any therapist will tell you, I say that with some trepidation, a group of Jews, a third of whom could probably be therapists and the other third attorneys, but with some degree of confidence, I think that most Jewish therapists would tell you that if you had a videotape and you played it against somebody's memories of what happened in their youth, they would believe their memories before the videotape. So when you go to a Muslim and you say, well, you know, Muhammad never physically went to Jerusalem, they went, oh, that's not what the Quran says. Yes, it is what the Quran says. But you can't argue with it. I talk to Muslims all the time, to Palestinians all the time, who had their parents, their grandparents, their great-parents had groves, had orchards. I'm pretty sure that my aunt planted the first orchards in Israel. Actually it was Palestine back then. Their historic memory is folkloric, as Sunni, as Shia, as Ashkenazi, as Sephardic. We're dealing with legends, and it's really hard to therapize. Not impossible, but it's really hard. There are long historic memories, and the memories don't have to be true in order to be either nourishing or toxic. And most of the memories are, at this point, are toxic and very hard to remediate. Why is it that Israel is this big insult, this cancer, this foreign body? Sometimes they'll say, well, I look around the room and those Israelis look like you, John, nothing against you personally, but they don't look like us. We, you know, it sounds like stuff that you used to hear in the South. We get along fine with our Jews. We've always had a good relationship with our Jews. Our Jews knew their place. And some of that is true. And last week I explained that some of that is true because Jews really didn't have armies, really weren't a threat to the larger societies, were an educated class, were doctors and lawyers and architects, and weren't a threat. And there was the common enemy of the Christians, who wanted to slaughter both Jews and Muslims and didn't distinguish between the two. And so that's part of why Jews and Muslims got along for a long time. And part of it is the Muslim position in the 20th century has been hugely anti-Zionist, and they have understood that as being anti-European. Many of them have understood Israel as being an outpost of Europe. Way before the Shoah, way before the issue was, well, this is Europe's guilt for the Holocaust, Faisal would not meet with T.E. Lawrence in order to tolerate Jewish immigration and purchases of land in the Holy Land, in Palestine. There have been cultural and ethnic and tribal issues from the beginning. You have to realize just how tribal that world is, just how complicated the family relations are, and how little we in the West understand what's going on. Let me give you a couple of examples. And I don't want to get overly political, even though there's an election going on, even as we speak, but in Israel. But when the United States went into Iraq, we didn't have a clue what we were dealing with. Arabists did. Some smart people in the State Department did. But most people didn't understand that there were three kinds of Kurds: Christian, Muslim, Shiite, and the Shiite Arabs were killing the Shiite Kurds, and there were communist Kurds also. So you didn't have just Kurds in the north. You had three different kinds, and they were fighting each other. In the absence of Saddam, they're fighting each other all the time, and the only thing that they can agree on is to hide from Saddam and to try to kill Turks. So those are the three groups of Kurds. We had three groups of Shiites. We had Shiite who were pretty secular, We had Arab Shiite, and we had ethnic Persian Shiite. Right now, the election that we just had, somebody just had in Iraq, the majority seems to have gone to the less religious Shiites who seem to be more or less ethnically controlled by Arabs. A lot of Iranian influence, but these do not seem to be ethnic Persians. So you have three groups of Shiites. Now take the Sunnis, please. You've got the Sunnis who are Ba'athist secularists. You've got the Sunnis who are Al-Qaeda Islamists. And then you've got the Shiites who are Kurds, and then you've got the Sunnis who are Kurds, and you've got the Sunnis who are Marsh Arabs. So you've got all of these ethnic religious groups, and I haven't even begun to talk about the tribal system. Do you have any idea how complicated it was and how the United States wanted to, just like Alexander cutting the Gordian knot, just say, hey, this is easy. All we need to do is. It's never easy. If you think you understand it, even if you think I understand it, don't believe me. Because this trying to understand it, and this is just Iraq. This is it's Nakhchivan in Afghanistan. This is just Iraq. If it is like trying to play three-dimensional chess on the back of a camel that's on a boat on the sea during a storm. It just keeps moving and keeps changing. So Bernard Lewis talks about how the real issue in the Middle East really is one of a sense of inferiority, that these countries have looked at themselves, these people have looked at themselves and said, we had all this oil, we had all this wealth, we had this history, this civilization from Iran and Cyrus the Great, Koresh, and to Granada, to all of the money in the world in the Omarites and the Emirates and in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And what do we have? We don't have a single regime that is decent. There isn't a single country that, if they had a democratic election, would elect somebody better by our standards. And let me say a word about democracy. This is really, really, really important. That's the other thing America didn't understand. I was moved also when I saw the purple fingers. Okay? People wanted to vote. They wanted their worlds to be better. Most people do. Most people are decent. Most Germans were decent. Didn't mean that they did decent things. Didn't mean that they were innocent. Didn't mean a whole bunch of stuff. It only takes a very few to poison a society and to lead a society. Anyway, I looked at the fingers. I was moved. But democracy is not one election. Democracy is the second and the third and the fourth election. One of the jokes of Africa was, after the colonial era, there's a free and fair election, and it's the first and it's the last. And you elect the president for life. And the president's life might be 10 minutes, or it might be Mugabe, and he just won't leave. But you know that the losers are not going to live to campaign another day. The losers are not going to have another chance at a free and fair election. So far in South Africa, it has not been... I'm sorry, for those of you that don't understand, South Africa, it is not... It's still up in the air. There was a peaceful transference of power from Mandela, who was not a perfect person, to Mbeki, who was even more not a perfect person, and Zuma appears to be even less of a perfect person. So we'll see. Three or four elections down the line, we'll see if there's democracy. An election does not create democracy. Democracy is a deal that we make that we're willing to let the other side live. So far, there's no evidence in the Middle East that the answer is democracy. I hate saying that. I hate hearing myself say that. I hate knowing that I'm being recorded at least twice saying that. But it's a big problem, because the great challenge that we have and that we're going to have is these generational handoffs that are happening, whether it's happened in Jordan to the kid or it's happened in Syria to the other kid. The attempt now of Mubarak to hand it off to his son, who's old enough now not to be a kid but also not to be terribly popular, is likely to be a disaster. And what's going to come next? A Muslim Brotherhood? None of this stuff is good news. Okay, so back to our subject. Islam encounters the West, and they only remember the Crusades. They remember that they got pushed out of Spain, 1492, they're gone, in their own little diaspora. They know that they were pushed back from the gates of Vienna. These were the Ottoman Turks. They remember that they were later invaded and taken over in the colonial era, and that some people were controlling the Turks, who were controlling far-flung territories, and there were corrupt regimes that were intermarrying with host country nationals, so that there were mixtures of Turks marrying with Ishmaelites, and King Farouk controlling Egypt. You had ethnic disputes that were going on all across the Arab world, and a fight between the light and the dark-skinned people in the Arab world. You have a real terrible mess. And what the Arab world remembers is the mess, and they blame it on England and France and Germany, and of course America and Israel. The phrase, you know, in where I live in the San Fernando Valley, "Oh my God" is one word. You know that, right? It's even before texting, "Oh my God" was one word. American Zionist Crusader is one word in the Arab world. That's their memory of their encounter with the West. That's not the reality of all of their encounter with the West, but that's their memory of it. They don't remember getting to the gates of Vienna. They remember being repulsed. They don't remember going over the Pyrenees. They remember being pushed out of Spain. They remember every insult and every slight and every excuse why their lands are at this moment not decent, and they really want to know why. And when you want to know why things are going badly, you have to find somebody to blame. Everybody does. Everybody does. This has been true of every people and every religion in history. Somebody's at fault. Sometimes it's me. Rarely. But sometimes it's, well, according to my wife, it's always me. But I mean, according to me, sometimes it's me. I'm at fault. But usually it's somebody else. Usually it's somebody else that brought all of the suffering on me. Somebody betrayed me. Somebody isn't working hard. Somebody is not doing it right. And for the Middle East, it's Israel. And that's the organizing principle of what's driving the Arab world today, and to some extent, the Muslim world today. The bad news is that I don't have a good fix for it. The bad news is that were I not a Zionist, and if I said, look, everybody, let's get on a plane and go to Utah. Let's get all of Israel and move Israel to Utah. Our people are a desert people. It's no problem. Sure, the Mormons will call us Gentiles, but it's okay. You know, all of the places have Hebrew names anyway, so and everything is, you know, 6 blocks from the temple and 3 blocks north to the temple. And, you know, the only downside is that wine is a controlled substance. Clinton had some when he was campaigning once, but didn't swallow. Anyway, even if we moved all of Israel, which would not be impossible, to, well, if Michael Chabon, to Alaska. Utah's better. To Baja? You want to go to Baja? Okay, Baja. Nothing would be different in the Middle East. That's the thing that you have to know. When you're involved in a rational conversation with an Arab, and I've been involved in rational conversations with Arabs, they understand. Nothing would be different. If Israel disappeared, God forbid, nothing would be different. They'd have to find somebody else. In California, let me use a really dangerous example. In California, if there were no Mexicans, do you think the people that hate Mexicans could find somebody else to hate? Somebody else to blame? Somebody else who's making, well, cleaning their houses and making their gardens and taking care of their children? I mean, the point is that we find somebody upon whom to put the burdens of our guilt. And the great irony for Jews is that for centuries, Jews who invented the scapegoat have been the scapegoat and are still the scapegoat. And so that even though the Muslims had more good years than bad with Jews, today this little tiny piece of real estate is the source of all of their problems and won't go away. Even if it were to go away, their problems would remain. And I don't know how you begin to remediate that, because I believe that it can be, but I don't have a comprehensive plan. The thing that's really important to remember is that even though that's their memory, the facts have been different for much of Muslim history, even though at the moment the loud and the obnoxious and the haters within Islam are saying, the Quran commands us to kill you. That's out of context, but that's how they're interpreting it. They don't have to interpret it that way forever, just as I'm sure very few of you sit around and interpret the Talmud as saying, I want you to go out and kill the best of the Gentiles. It's a remark made in a context. But that's they're not doing the context. Right now, they are doing this fundamentalistic reading. And when I'm saying they are doing it, I don't mean all of Islam. I don't mean all Muslims. I don't even mean the majority. But the number is sufficient with over 1.3 billion Muslim Arabs in the world that it's a very dangerous world for us. The problem is not in the religion, though. It's really not. It's not in the theology. It's really not. It really is the same God. It is in the history. It is in this moment that we have come to where they can't see our humanity, and it's getting harder and harder for us to see their humanity. As this conflict has gone on over the last 100 years, the last 50 have gotten worse and worse and worse. The language with which they have described Jews has gotten more dirty and violent and insulting and condescending. And some of the language right now in the Israeli campaign is not quite as dirty and condescending, but it's a lot worse than it used to be. Now, the only funny part of all of this, there's very little in anti-Semitism that is funny, but the one thing in anti-Semitism that is funny in the Arab world is the absence of a sense of irony. When you look at Muslim anti-Semitic caricatures, they look just like the ones that were taken out of the medieval period of Europe. They draw caricatures of Jews that don't look like anyone in this room. They look like everybody in Saudi Arabia. And they have no sense of perspective or irony about this. They're just drawing these anti-Semitic pictures that look like Faisal. And I don't know why they don't have a sense of irony about it, but they don't. For me, this is about history. This is about all of the things that have brought us to this moment. It is both assuring and unassuring that our differences religiously and theologically are really very slight. We deal with the same God. We have an unmediated religion, as they have an unmediated religion, unlike Christianity, that is mediated through a Savior and through saints. But we are in a political moment where we can't hear each other. There's one more thing about their encounter with the West. And I said last week that I promised to tell you a little bit about Abd ibn Wahhab. The Wahhabis are named after him, and he would have hated that, something else that's ironic, because he was the Jonathan Edwards. You know the old Jonathan Edwards, the American revivalist of the late 18th century? He did the famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. You're all a bunch of sinners, and there's nothing but the hand of God staying you from the flames of hell. And anyway, he was that kind of Muslim preacher. And if I could sustain that for 20 minutes, I could make a living. But it catches in my throat. This is what Ibn Ibn Wahhab did. He saw that Muslims were being called Mohammedans, and he said, no, we're not. We don't worship a man like Christians worship Jesus. We are Muslims. We submit to God. He saw that the Europeans had influence on Muslims, and that Muslims were playing games like chess. Checkmate is from Shah Mahmud, the king is dead. He saw that they were gambling and playing music and getting unorthodox. Some of them were eating shrimp. Some of them were eating pork. They were being dissolute. And he wanted to purify the holy Sunni religion. And he intermarried, and his family was intermarried with the House of Saud. And he went about saying, we're Muslims, we're not Mohammedans. He went about trying to get rid of 1,000 years of enlightenment, 1,000 years of Muslim positive experience as well as negative experience with the West. And he is the most important figure for us in the 21st century in the Sunni world, because of everything that he did to snuff out the light of the Enlightenment. I told you the story, our first session together, about meeting with this scholar of Islam who talked about how Judaism and Islam and Christianity had gotten past all of the problems with racism and violence, and but it was in the DNA of Islam, and they needed to have an enlightenment. No, what Wahhab shows is that you can have had an enlightenment, and somebody can come and turn the lights out. When I went and I saw Inherit the Wind 50 years ago, I never dreamed we'd be talking about evolution 50 years later, and that 5 out of 7 presidential candidates for some unnamed political party would raise their hand if asked if they didn't believe in evolution. The issue here is that the lights can be put out, and Islam's light was put out. So when I say our struggle isn't with Islam, but it is with militant, angry, violent, insecure crazies, that's exactly what I mean. We can live with secular Muslims. There have been secular Muslims. If our world is going to survive, there'll be secular Muslims again someday. But the violent and the militant and the intolerant, the ones that will pick up the Quran and pick up a verse that says, and you must destroy the people who reject God, we can't make a modus vivendi with them today. We can't pretend that they're not saying the things that they're saying. You know, there's a lot of trash talk in the Middle East. Ahmadinejad does a lot of trash talk. But the lesson of the Jewish world in the 20th century is, when somebody says, I'm sorry, you have no right to be at the table. I don't have to let you get up from the table alive. I don't recognize you as a human being. And it pains me, but you really need to die. and I want to just not simply wipe you out, but wipe out the rest of the row and the people behind you and everybody else. It could just be trash talk. But the lesson of the 20th century is you can't assume that it's trash talk. There were, despite what Williamson said, ovens and showers and bullets and hatred, and not simply personal hatred, but technology turned towards the Vernichtung, the annihilation, the turning into nothing of a people against their interests of the Germans. This is what's so horrifying when you try to deal rationally with the Middle East. Now, I'm about to come to the question period, but let me end on this. This is what's horrifying when you're trying to deal rationally with the Middle East. People act adverse to their reason and their interests. If Hitler had not been an anti-Semit, Einstein, Fermi, Bohr, Oppenheimer, Teller, who do you think would have had the atomic bomb first, if he had not been an anti-Semit? Wir werden alle Deutsch sprechen hier, ja? Wirklich. So the problem, even when I am giving you a rational view and telling you that most Muslims are decent and want peace, and if I look at Iran, as we will in 2 weeks at 8 o'clock at night, when we look at Iran and say, well, look, they've got a lot of things to lose. They would not choose to have war because they have an infrastructure. Afghanistan's got nothing. Afghanistan might as well bomb, you know, Antarctica. They've got nothing. These various non-state actors have nothing. But the Iranians have something. They're rational actors, even if they're evil. I can't really be that confident that they're going to choose rationally, because so many people, so many societies have worked adverse to their own interests. However, I do have to act as if people are capable on a day-to-day basis of choosing rationally. So this is our question or comment time. You got your hand up first? A simple question, I'll believe that.
Muslim and Muslim. Are they interchangeable?
Yes.
One right, one wrong. Who says which, please?
Okay, so the question between Muslim and Muslim. Where is my introducer?
Miriam.
Oh, she was concerned whether I was Dobra or Dabra. And I'm Dabra east of the Mississippi and Dobra west of the Mississippi. That's true. They're the same. It is. So Islam means one who means submission to the will of God. Muslim or Muslim means one who submits. There is, let's see if you can make this connection. They have a word for learning that is lamed, and a person who teaches is called a mulamed. And mulam, well. Mu'alim is the verb, the person, anyway, in my dialect. Yes, sir. Yours is Egyptian. You see, I always get into trouble with Egypt. My Egyptian story is I would sit in the cafes, the qahwas, and we'd be speaking Arabic. Then we'd go to a movie. All the movies were in Egyptian. I would understand hattashay, hattakilma. I would understand nothing, because the dialect is very different from my dialect. Yes, sir?
I'll take some exception.
Okay.
You had a great elision in your discussion of Israel. Oh, yes. You had a great elision in your discussion of Israel. From the earliest days, let us say from 100 years after Muhammad, and the writing of the Quran, and I can read it here if you'd like.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of Fai territory,
right,
which belongs to the Waqf,
right,
for the eternal time until the day of resurrection.
Right.
Israel is part of the eternal Waqf. Can you tell me of any religious person, aside the United States and Europe,
mm-hmm,
any Muslim leader who's a religious person who said
this can be discarded and we do not have to pay attention?
No. The comment is that Islam, when you look at the entire Middle East, Jerusalem was clearly Muslim by 650. So that's within their territory. They can kill you to take it back. And no Muslim leader is going to say, in today's climate, we're only kidding. Now, does it mean that they have never said it, or they cannot bargain it, or they can't make a deal around it? The truth is, now this is where we get into the contentious part of religion. Everybody knows how to make a deal when it suits your interest. I have studied the Torah, and I'm sure there are people here who have studied it far greater than I have, and I can find no Torah passage that tells me whether to use 7-pound or 12-pound monofilament when creating an eruv, because that is put together so that I can avoid, and rationalize some ways of living in a community. I may have told you the story where I was traveling with somebody and he was doing something he shouldn't be doing on the Shabbat. And he said, well, it's waived if you're over a body of water. I said, we're in Missouri. And he gets up and he shows me a water bag that he's sitting on. Muslims can't say it's okay for you to live there. But they could rent it to you for 1,000 years. They just can't say that it would be okay to give it to you. The point is that when it's in our interest to lend money, to find a way of getting interest without calling it interest, we can rationalize it. When we don't want to do it, we simply kill you. So everything that you say is true. And yet, with the right attorneys, there are ways through it, and with goodwill. And the problem is not finding the right attorneys. The problem is finding the goodwill. One more. Okay, two more. I'm weak. Yell on me. Yeah.
I think we have to think about, and we don't have an answer, the role of
My name is Carol, and the thing that you have to think about.
Hi, my name is Carol, and what we all have to think about is the role of American and foreign policy since World War II, when we have been propping up the Saudi Arabia, Egyptian, and Jordanian governments, which are far from democracies, because they say they're pro-West, they give us the oil, whatever. And our role in Iraq and putting the Ba'ath Party in power.
And taking them out.
And then taking, and now Saddam Hussein, and in Iran putting the Shah in power, which led to the revolution and the current problems. So a lot of the angry Muslim world towards Americans is really based on American foreign policy, and since September 11, 2001, our government and our American media have done a good job of blaming everything on Arabs and Muslims and demonizing them instead of just saying maybe there are a few people who did something bad.
We're nice to each other. Listen, don't make me stand in between you guys, okay? You know?
And,
let her finish.
People around the world think that Israel is kind of like an ally of the United States, and is American foreign policy towards Israel, a lot of people think it's in balance because Israel is always thought of as being right.
Is there a question for me coming?
No, I just think these are things we have to think about. The other thing is, on a positive note, is the Union of Reform Judaism, Jewish Reform Movement, and the Islamic Society of North America have created a national initiative for interfaith dialogue on a national level and on a local level.
Okay.
San Diego will be participating. I don't have details, but they'll be coming out.
May I have a suggestion?
Sure. And now with a responsible opposing point of view. But everybody, listen. We talk about the Middle East. One of the things is compassionate listening and being kind to each other. It's kind of important to model. If you want to have some hope in the larger world, start in the room.
I'm Shlomo Kaspi. My question is, I was in the Muslim Museum in Jerusalem
and talk about 144 shuras, mm-hmm. or you call it shuras, I think.
Yeah, suras.
Suras. Nine of them constitute the Quran. The shuras in the Quran are not in the chronological order.
Right.
That if there is a conflict between shuras, mm-hmm. there were one who was written later.
Right.
It's controlling the right. opinion. However, nobody knows what order they were written.
Right.
What's true about it?
Well, actually, everything that you said is true. There are a lot. Surahs are the chapters. They are put together not in chronological order, not even thematically. They are often repetitive. They tell the same story. Sometimes they tell them a little differently, as does Torah, absolutely. And the later ones are more controlling because some scholar has to decide, and it's usually, frankly, it's not very hard. When he's talking nicely about the Jews, it's an early surah. When he's talking badly about the Jews, it's a later surah. You can just remember it rhymes with surahs. And the last comment.
Yes, I have a great disagreement on...
Closer. What? Disagree louder.
I think there's a great disagreement about how getting along with the Muslims. You indicate that it's not so much the religion. And you talk about the golden age of Jews and Muslims mm-hmm. getting together. The golden age in which the Jews had to wear an armband so they know they're mm-hmm. Jewish. Mm-hmm. They had to be put in a special portion of the city. They could not make their synagogues beyond a certain level height. Mm-hmm. Later on, they could not even build a synagogue. They mm-hmm. could only renovate the synagogue. If a Muslim person knew a Jewish person and he met him on the street, he is not supposed to greet him. He is supposed to...
No, that's too, you're now too big. All of that is true in snapshots in periods of time. All of that's true. I'm not disputing any of it.
Let me go on from
okay.
there. Let me go on from there. In the religion, Jews... No, this is very important. Jews were permitted to live among Muslims,
yeah.
but they were only permitted to live in a subordinate position.
Yeah, in the dhimmi.
They're not supposed to be... over anybody else. They're not supposed to work for a Jew,
mm-hmm.
and it's completely horrible for them to have Israel,
mm-hmm.
where the Jews are predominant,
mm-hmm.
and the Arabs are subordinate. It's completely against their religion, and it is a religious thing. It isn't just,
okay.
let's all get along. And also, as far as Muhammad is concerned, they look at him as a role model.
Mm-hmm.
And as a role model, he made deals
mm-hmm.
to later conquer.
Right.
For the time being, it paid him to make a deal with these pagans. Then after he got enough power, he broke the deal
right.
and decimated them.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So we have a big religious problem with the Muslim, and I think you glossed over.
Okay. Let me go back. Everything he says is true. But I can do the same thing within Christianity. I can do, let me make sure I get into real trouble now. I can do the same thing within some areas of Judaism in terms of attitudes and in terms of restriction. All of it is true, but it isn't all true at the same time across the breadth of the Muslim world. It's true. When I last week I talked about the father, the Catholic who's part of our interfaith dialogue. When we ask him, do Jews get salvation? He hems and he haws. He believes his religion is right and we're wrong and God loves him better and we're not getting good seats, if any seats of paradise. All of that stuff is true, but it's not true of everyone eternally across the board. Do Muslims today largely believe? This is, see, here's the, this. I'll end with this. This is a great thing about humanity. I can be arrogant and condescending when I'm right because I know I'm right, and I can be just as arrogant and condescending when I'm afraid I'm wrong. And that's the situation that the Muslims are in today. In a large segment, in a large part of the Muslim world. It does not mean that crusades go on forever. It doesn't mean that fatwas are eternal. You're absolutely right. Jews were always considered dhimmi, and diminished in terms of rights and in terms of obligations. But when I talk about it, and last week I was very clear, it was not Eden. It was just Eden next to Poland. And, you know, that should also give one some sense of hope. Poland has not become Eden either, by the way. And there are still lots of problems, as we see currently in the Christian world. But the issue is, you take it at its very worst, whether it's Nazism or the Inquisition or the Crusades, or do you take it at its very best, or do you understand that the world is plastic and we have some influence on it, not permanent influence on it, that when one of the great controversies in Judaism was between whether God created ex nihilo out of nothing or whether God shaped the chaos, and whether the chaos will hold form, or whether we, as part of co-creators with God, have the responsibility of trying to push it into shape because it doesn't want to stay. And I guess that would be my position. My position is that you don't get eternal hell with either Christians or with Muslims, or eternal Eden, that all of us have to work in order to make it better, because we are stuck with a horrible truth that is like aging and like death and like gravity. We don't have to like it. But right now, more of them are willing to die than we're willing to kill. And the answer is not necessarily for us to learn to want to kill more of them. We should be looking at other alternatives, understanding that there are no perfect or permanent alternatives. But we cannot get them to accept our humanity by diminishing theirs. Now, it may be that we can never get them to accept our humanity. That is a possibility. But I have to act as if what I do makes some difference, or else I'll stay in the bed and just cry myself to sleep, which I will do until I see you in 2 weeks at 8 o'clock at night.
Thank you.